Bonjour. Now that I've traversed the entire world with my greetings, honorable members, I trust that we can start our meeting. Let me first of all express my gratitude to all of you honorable members for availing yourselves to be at this special meeting today, the purpose of which is to receive a briefing from the Department of Higher Education and Training on the amendments to the National Qualifications Framework Amendment Bill. And let me also take the opportunity to express my thanks to the department and the ministry for also availing yourself to come and give us a briefing on the bill. So we have on my right hand side the members of the department and the ministry, and then the legal advisors, state law advisors are here also if we wish to ask any questions to them, honorable members. Before I proceed with the meeting, we have apologies from honorable member from the EFF, and those are the only apologies that we have received. Honorable members, you would agree and join us in expressing our condolences to the family of Professor Moyose, and as well as the family of the University of Cape Town, on a very sad loss of a extremely outstanding professor that we have lost, and you would agree that we extend that condolences to both of the university and to the family also. We are extremely sad about what has happened and the cause of the death also. The last one is you would I trust join that we congratulate the Cape Peninsula University, CPUT, that they have finally got a vice chancellor in the name of, what's his name? Jan Slapo, the very energetic, the very energetic one that gave us a briefing. So we are very happy that they are getting the act together and have got a vice chancellor finally, and we trust that the board can now, the council at least, can now be sorted out also, and that should take that institution, I trust, to better heights. So we will express our congratulations to them for doing that also. As I said, honourable members, we are here to receive the briefing from the department. I trust we can proceed to invite, with your permission, the department to do that. We will thereafter discuss just the passage of the bill in terms of both the rules and the constitution and what our duties are in this instance. We have felt that we need to meet today. We think that the bill is also an important one. We also think that we must have an obligation to make sure that we can invite people to give further comment on the bill also, and we think meeting today does help us to give a bit of time, so when we come back formally in 2 weeks' time, we trust that we would have received responses to the bill also. But let's start with the briefing first, and then as members we will discuss all of that. In order, honourable members?
Yep.
As Dr. Lloyd, are you going to lead us? Advocate. I work with professors all the time, so it sticks.
Thank you for the invitation, Chair, and honorable members, good morning. I first want to also apologize on behalf of the Director General who can't be here today, with the permission of the committee, if I can then make the presentation on behalf of the Director General. Chair, we've got a presentation which has been slightly adjusted from the one that was originally forwarded to the committee. I'm using the adjusted version, and I put it on the screen in order to make sure that there's no confusion. Chair, the purpose of the amendment to the National Qualification Framework Act is basically to ensure that fraud and corruption are dealt with at all levels. It is a phenomenon which has been originally identified in the employment matters, but it actually went much further than that. It also involved appointments to boards, foreign appointments, and it has an impact on a very wide society. The issue of the concept of fraud and corruption is an aspect that must be dealt with, and the bill seeks to provide a solution to identify the responsibility to deal with the identification of these fraudulent and misrepresented qualifications, and the purpose is to assist in that structure. The Department of Higher Education has seen it fit to ensure that people are skilled and educated in a credible way, and therefore the value of a qualification and the reflection of the qualification on the National Qualification Framework Act in terms of the NQF Act is a very important part of the system, and it is important that the credibility of the qualifications must be reflected in a way where the identification of fraud and corruption and the awarding of that qualifications in that manner must be dealt with and must be published for open consumption, and also to deal with the so-called misrepresented qualifications, which I alluded to later on. The amendment bill obviously addressed new definitions. It introduced definitions for fraud, misrepresentation, and also dealing with verification and also evaluation in a more defined manner. It also provides a number of other definitions which is related to the substance of the legislation, and what is also really important, the aspect of the powers of SAQWA to verify, which was under contestation by different opinions, has now been clarified in terms of this legislation. In summary, the Cabinet approved that the minister must institute measures to curb misrepresented qualifications and the presentation of invalid qualifications in the public sector, and all persons who misrepresent their qualifications or organizations that issue invalid qualifications accountable for those actions. The Inquiry Amendment Bill was published for public comment on the 18th of November 2016, and we worked with the Office of the State Law Advisor in the drafting and in the process of getting the preliminary opinion on which a process must be followed in the legislation, as well as to the certification of the legislation in order to table it in Parliament. Chair, the public comment that we received was quite involved. It is an area which has which caused a lot of reaction, and in many cases we had to deal with more than one consultation with the same entity who raised from which we received comments. I'm not going to deal with it in the slide or the names that have been read here that we've of the parties that we've consulted with, but Chair, it is important that it covers institutions, it covers private providers, it deals with private companies involved in providing a service of verification of qualifications, and it also deals with other important role players in the broader society. I'm back on track. The strategic focus that we've drafted the bill, we've considered the National Skills Development Plan, which requires access to education and training of the highest quality, leading to improved learning outcomes, and that is the whole issue of credibility of qualifications. The outcome of the MTSF, which is increased in access to programs leading to intermediate and higher level learning, high level occupational directed programs and occupational directed programs as needed areas, and the white paper for PSE with the NQF overarches the entire education and training system of South Africa, that which is also covered by the three sub-frameworks. The first draft of the NQF Amendment Bill was published for comments in November 2016. Did receive comments and inputs from various individuals and organizations. The comments were considered and amended, and amendments were made, including comments from the state law advisors during the certification process. The main objectives of the NQF Amendment Bill, they are to amend and strengthen the current act, ratify inconsistencies and closes gaps in the act. The bill also addresses the following issues: provides enabling mechanism for SAQWA and the three QCs to have the legislative competency to manage the process of fraudulent and misrepresented qualifications. And Chair, it is important that we just refer back to the definition fraud is a what obviously is a common law offence where a specific intent is required in order to be guilty of that offence. We've seen a number of statutory comparable offences, and with this piece of legislation, it is also to customize specific offences relating to the conduct, the fraudulent conduct of individuals, where a court of law must then pronounce a finding in order to be reflected as a fraudulent qualification, and the consequence of registering it on the register under the domain of SACWA. But there are a number of other qualifications where it is not necessary fraud, but it is an honest mistake that caused the problem. We've already identified in the amendment to the Higher Education Act, section 65, capital BA, where a university are making a mistake and issue a degree certificate, and that they now have the power in terms of that provision to revoke that qualification. But we didn't have the same provision for across the system, and with the approach that is now put in this bill is to ensure that the misrepresented qualifications, which are qualifications that were issued on a mistake, or where it is also not compliant to the standards or to the level descriptors of the qualifications reflected on that certificate, must then be corrected or clarified in terms of a process where SACWA must evaluate and deal with the equivalency of that qualification, if at all possible, and to provide a outcome which is consistent to the requirements and standards of a qualification at the level. So, Chair, the SACWA must also develop and publish the registers for fraudulent and misrepresented qualification, and SACWA must also advise the Minister on the NKF matters after consultation with the Quality Councils. Chair, this is it's a slight amendment, but a very important one, because we've picked up that sometimes advice are coming to the Minister from SACWA, that the QCs will say we haven't been consulted, we are not aware of it, and we also get advice from the QCs, and SACWA will say we are not involved in that. And say it is important, if we work in a system, that cohesion is provided for in the legislation. And we also identify later on that when we come to the QCs, the words, it is advised to the Minister after consultation with the Quality Council, in the case of SACWA, and in the case of the Quality Council, it is also in consultation with the SACWA when the advice is provided to the Minister. The NKF bill provides for amendments to the following areas. It is amending the long title. It amends new definitions. It provides for the registered private institution after the registered qualification must be accredited by the relevant qualification council to offer such a qualification. It is really important that registration of the private provider, because it's linked to section 29 of the constitution, And it is a registration which is provided as the three sub-conditions that is put in Section 29 of the Constitution, that it cannot discriminate on the basis of race. It must deal with a registration of with the state, is the wording in the Constitution, and it must comply with standards that's comparable to a public institution. So here it is to tie that responsibility also into the NQF Act, where the qualification offering and compliance to quality education standards in the offering of the qualifications, which ultimately result in also the registration of the private institution, and the wording that's used in the bill is also of your private skills providers. Chair, it also gives the authority to SAQWA to verify qualifications and part qualifications. I already alluded to the fact that there will be a contestation through opinions from the state law advisor, which indicated that SAQWA didn't have such an authority. With this amendment, that problem is resolved, and if Parliament accept the amendment, it is abundantly clear now that verification is part of evaluation, and that is part and parcel of the competencies of SAQWA. The register for fraudulent qualifications and the register for misrepresented qualifications, as both of them are introduced into the bill, as separate registers and with a specific scope to each one of them, as defined in the amendment bill. It also clarify the issue of the register of professional designation, which is currently in the Act, but it is not indicated as a separate register, and it caused confusion because there is an interpretation that it should be on the National Qualification Framework, which professional designation is not a qualification, it is not a part qualification, and therefore it is the intention is to ensure that that link is still there with the NQF, but as a separate register that is also under the control of SAQWA, who got the responsibility of registering the professional bodies and also registering the professional designations on the advice of the professional bodies, which is already contained in the current legislation. The legal duty to report misrepresented qualification by education institutions, providers and employers are also a very important introduction to the legislative framework. It is a manner to ensure that the national learner database is current. It is an all-inclusive learner database, and if there are any qualifications or part qualifications that can be proved that they are, they've been compliant to all the requirements and issued in terms of the legislative provision and not reflected on the database, that obligation is to report it so that SAQWA can correct it and make sure that the learner database is 100% up to date. The bill further address compulsory referral of certain employees' qualifications or part qualification to SAQWA for verification, specifically your government employees, and it is also already a trend that most of your appointments to specific structures, statutory bodies, are also the members who have been proposed to serve on those structures are also, their qualifications are also verified by SAQWA. Further, it provides the creation of offences, as I've already alluded to, which is linked to existing common law offences that are tailor-made for the specific circumstances of falsification of qualifications and fraudulent tampering with qualifications in order to reflect a qualification which is not earned by the holder of that document. The legislation also addresses matters connected with the issues mentioned above. The other considerations, the implementation plan, we've considered a feasible time frame for implementation. It is important that in order to deal with some of the issues, there are already systems in place. SAQWA already started with a listing of misrepresented and fraudulent qualifications. Although it's not official, it is already providing transitional arrangements to deal with the need to register it based on the directive that came from Cabinet for them to start with that process. This will feed into the formalization of this bill when it comes to the different registers and also the cleaning up of the National Learner Database. The organizational and personnel implications, the implementation will be will be through the current SAQWA structures and the relevant quality councils. So it is not any new structures or committees that has been identified to deal with the implications. Financial implications, Chair, it is a reality of life. Whenever there are changes, it will have some financial implications. It is important that the Act and the relevant legislation really deals with the funding allocations which come through Parliament and other means as is prescribed in Section 21C of the current Act, and that aspect is still in place, and it will also be the sections that will deal with whatever financial implications is coming out of, if any, coming out of this amendment. The communication implications, the GCIS could be consulted, and the Minister's communication and DHET website and social media have been used already, but once the Act comes into to effect, we will deal with all the communications strategies in order to ensure that the rollout and implementation are thoroughly understood and also implemented. Constitutional implications, there are none, except, as I've indicated, the link to Section 29 of the Constitution, which is just providing clarity that your skills development private providers must also comply with the registration with the state, which is the Department of Higher Education and Training. The implication for vulnerable groups is none that we could identify. identify, and security implications, we could not identify any implications either. Departments that we've and parties that we've consulted, I've already provided a whole table of all the bodies by name, but basically it is SAQUA and the Quality Councils. We've also consulted with all the branches in the EA, as the NPF is overarching the whole of the department. We've dealt with key role players and stakeholders in PSET, such as USAF, CETAS, institutions, organized business and labor. We received, Chair, although it is reflected at 48, but we've actually counted it's 45, we actually counted it's 48, because some of the institutions and bodies had provided more than one submission to us, and therefore in total, although it is not 45 different entities that we've received, 48 different entities that we've consulted with, but we received 48 comments from the various role players, different comments from different documents from those role players. The DDME issued a socio-economic impact assessment certificate and recommended that the amendments should continue to be considered by Parliament. So, Chair, that is the process, and I thank you for the opportunity to make this presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bossos. Any additions? Dr. Lloyd, anyone else from the department? Any further additions? No. Honourable members, it's over to yourselves to engage and ask questions. Honourable Van der Westhuizen and Bazzoli, and I've got you.
Thank you.
I've noted you, Honourable Kekana, and welcome, Honourable Member.
Thank you, Chair. Can I continue? Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for the briefing that we got. Just three questions at this stage. My impression is that the government would like to bring the so-called informal training institutions into the mainstream and into the registered or the realm of registered institutions. Now, I see in terms of the Amendment Act as well as in the original Act that we don't speak of training institutions but only of educational institutions. So my question is just, if I set up a cooking school to develop the skills of people to, let's say, cook in the French tradition or something like that, and I'm going to issue my own certificate to say you've been here, you've attended for 3 weeks, this is the topics or the content that we've covered, and I find you afterwards in a practical test to be competent. Is that addressed at all? Would that still be allowable? What is the position? Because eventually we want to develop people's skills. The second one is, in terms of your definition of such an education institution, what is the position of the satellite offices of foreign training institutions where the qualification that eventually is achieved is issued by an entity with, let's say, its base in another country? Because we do find and we do see a trend where people tend to sometimes even favor international qualifications, as they believe that that may, you know, be opening doors to them also when they must go and do project work abroad, etc. And then the last one that I do not see covered here at all is the whole position of online training, where we find more and more that you can enroll for qualifications all over the world, and all the work is being done online in terms of your study material as well as the assessments that you are doing. It seems to me what the current thinking is that should still be allowed, it should still continue. We do not want to curb that at all. And it's only when somebody claims to possess a qualification registered by one of the South African QCs that it is therefore controlled by this legislation. I would appreciate your responses. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I've got two questions. One is, if more people are going to be brought under the umbrella of the NQF, will you be including a simplification of the procedures required? For example, just to follow on Mr. van der Westhuizen's question, informal training institutions, if they are going to have to be submitted to this, they don't have the capacity to actually ask for accreditation, which requires an endless number of forms to fill in. And they just don't have the capacity because they're small and they have, you know, low profit, cheap institutions. So simplification of the rules would seem to me to be essential. And then secondly, on the fraudulent side, I mean, it's really good that you're saying we must tighten up on fraud, but I'm just wondering whether this will actually have any effect. Because if you look at it, illegal qualifications have already been subject to the law. You could already charge someone with fraud if they misrepresent their qualifications. So there isn't really anything new here other than writing it down. And the question that comes up is, well, who is going to charge these people? You know, small institution that has somebody arriving claiming to have a PhD and they don't have a PhD. They're not going to take them to court. They're going to fire them, perhaps, if you're lucky. But they're not going to get involved in a court case. So who is going to actually spearhead the court cases for fraud that will drive this new provision? And I have a feeling nobody is going to, unless somebody is designated as the body to take this up and take it seriously. Most institutions can't afford to charge a fraudulent staff member with fraud. They fire them anyway, so they're no longer under their rules. They don't have the money, and often they don't have the reputational courage to do it because it makes you look bad if you take your staff members to court. So I have a feeling that this won't make much difference to the existing situation, which is that you could have charged an employee who has misled you with fraud under the existing law, and nobody really seems to do that. So if it's going to be an inhibiting thing, don't you need some provision within it that there will be a branch within SACWA or somewhere that will take responsibility for pursuing court cases? Not every court case, because you might find thousands of court cases, but pursuing relevant and important court cases and placing some obligation on the professional bodies to pursue court cases as well, because they also perhaps have the wherewithal and the vested interest in doing so to protect their qualification. Thank you.
Honourable Kekana. Can somebody assist to switch on the microphone?
Chair, thanks. The first question is on skills, because we need so much of those skills And like my colleagues have said, if we don't do something, we don't seem to be catching up with the demand for skills, though people, there's high unemployment in the country. Now, Chair, the first question, this thing of people who have a long experience of apprenticeship, say the father is a mechanic, the child grows up helping the father, to an extent that in our communities they'll tell you that this boy is so good that he's now better than his father. He does it better than his father. If his father is stuck, this boy does it. So that type of long time experience, it is all over the show in our, the builders, the carpenters, just out of life experience. Some have worked in factories for a long time, 30 years, and when they go to pension, they want to open their own business. But at the beginning, we doubt because we don't know that how good he is. So the question is, how do we, in the bill, make sure that these people are accreditation? Initially, we thought the CETA was going to do it, but I haven't seen not even a single person out of that type of experience being accredited by the CETA. So how can we either attach the technical colleges, TVET colleges, to have a department that does this, or just something credible where they can acquire the certificate so that we go there with confidence that they've been checked and they are really able to do this work. Just for us to catch up with the demand for skills, because skills are there, but they are not recognized. The second question is on people who in the past, during the Cold War, if you can explain it again, were training in the OSOPEC, the countries like Somalia, Romania, Bulgaria, in the Eastern Bloc. And when they come, their certificates are not recognized, tertiary certificate. They've got to rewrite and go for an exam. How is that covering those type of people? And lastly, the people inside the country, I mean, let's be honest, we know that back in university there was no academic freedom. So books that were read at liberal and African universities, some of them were banned at universities. Even in natural sciences, they were not taught the same thing. We know that design of a system. How do we make sure that we there's parity as far as the Act is concerned and the accreditation is equal to all?
Honorable Kilian, followed by Honorable Kubisa. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, thanks for the presentation today. We all realize that today is just an informal session with the department because obviously the bill was introduced during recess, etc., and this is the first step in our committee process. I just wanted to make two points at the outset and then ask two questions. The one is, I think it's a good thing that we finally take a step. In fact, we have recommended a tightening 2 years and more ago because we realized that there were, for instance, that there was a gap. SAQWA is supposed to jealously guard our qualifications and to make sure that those who study hard to obtain them and that the credibility of those qualifications are not affected by all the sort of fake qualifications that came, was circulating around. Now, if we look at the SAQWA reports of the past couple of years, we should all be very concerned, because there was a huge escalation. And unfortunately, I hear what Honorable Kakana is saying, but we should also be very mindful that the majority, two-thirds of those qualifications were in fact so-called international qualifications. Now, no country in the world should not protect its qualification framework, and we have had good reports on our qualification framework, but we should jealously guard that, and that is government's responsibility to do so. So I think we should welcome it. In fact, Chairperson, I think if I can remember, 1,276 qualifications were reported in the 27th January period. And of those, 832 were fake foreign qualifications, fraudulent foreign qualifications. 444 were national qualifications. But the point that I'm making is, irrespective of whether they're foreign or South African fake, if they're fraudulent, they're fraudulent, and we should act. Second point is that there was a gap that SAQA couldn't operate as a sort of, with the sub-framework being the responsibility of the quality councils. They couldn't really perform their function to protect all our qualifications. That is what is understood from the presentation to us. Chair, there's two questions that I just needed clarity on. If we have these fake registers, registers of fraudulent and misrepresented qualifications, will it be online available? In other words, is it an open secret? And secondly, the courts have found in the past, and other institutions have exposed fraudulent qualifications. Will all of those be incorporated into that so that we can really close the gap? And it could act as a deterrent that we are wide awake in the future, and we will make sure that whatever qualification is offered, that people will know that it will mean something in the marketplace. If people are going around, continue going around to some of these colleges and only to find after 2 or 3 years of study that the qualification that they received, the certificate, means nothing, then we have not performed our responsibility. And all fingers will point at us that we didn't act in time. So I do think we can go into the detail later on, but the principle that we are discussing right now in an informal manner is we just want to have clarity about that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a few questions that I want to ask. Number one, are you going to do some footwork? For instance, in the main cities and towns, because this fraudulent behavior happens there the most, where you find a proliferation of institutions that are not registered. And we have students coming from rural areas and they're desperate to get an institution and they find themselves registering with these institutions. And this has been going on for quite some time. As we speak, there are, but a preponderance of them is in towns and cities. That's number one, whether footwork will be done. And then as we move closer to other institutions that are already operating, you'll find that they've been operating for years, but the qualifications that they are offering are not registered. Lecturers do not have the right qualifications, courses offered. These are all the issues that are there. And sometimes an institution chairperson will be registered, but with time it will become lax. And then, for instance, it registers a diploma in business studies with certain courses or modules. As time goes on, it deviates from that. Then it will add other modules or courses that are not accredited. You find that at the end of the day, like it happens with the public institutions, those institutions that registered their LLP because they sort of find at the end of the day they had to be deregistered. Some of them have resubmitted for approval. So these are issues that are at stake, let alone a plethora of institutions that are offering PhDs, and you find that an institution, yes, is registered, but doesn't have the right to offer PhDs, and you find that most of these staff members or lecturers now award themselves some honorary degrees. So you find that the profile is very good, but the entire thing is fraudulent. So what is it that will be done with regard to that? I mean, the punitive measures that will be taken. And of course, another issue that has been mentioned by colleagues, these transnational or international accreditation, the institution claims to be connected with an institution in Russia, in Rome, or whatever. But I find that as you follow up on that, it's not correct. And it also offers a very a wrong profile as well. So the whole thing, Chairperson, is good. It's a move to the right direction, but the whole question of punitive measures taken, serious punitive measures, and also footwork on the ground to ensure that these things do not happen. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Welcome, Honorable Dudley.
Thank you very much. A while back, we debated in the House a situation where students, medical students who were training and getting their degrees, etc., overseas, also doing their community and internship training in those countries, coming back here and finding that 4 years later they still... There's issues around writing exams, there's issues around having to redo their training, and the Deputy Minister at the time absolutely agreed that it was problematic and that these students shouldn't be discriminated against and promised that they'd be doing something. Now, my feedback is that some things have been done, but it's not actually, it's not clearing up the situation and people are still finding the blockage, and I just wondered if you were able to comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Let me first thank the Department for the briefing on the amendment bill. For me, I think this is a good bill and it's long overdue. I have one worry, Chairperson, that this is a good bill and it's long overdue, but my worry is that long-drawn legal battles will increase the legal costs of SACWA and the QCs when there are litigations and appeals. So I think I want to agree with my colleagues that resourcing of the QCs and SACWA is critical in order to ensure that this bill is implemented. I just wanted to raise the issue of funding or resources that or resourcing that it must not be left unattended to, because it is critical in the implementation of this bill. And when we look currently, there are many fraudsters that are benefiting illegally from employment that they don't deserve. Thank you, Chair.
In the absence of any other hands, just before I hand over to yourselves to answer, I think the latter question or the last question by Honorable Mpunu is key for us, which is around the financing and resources. We've had the queues, all the queues before us, and they have sufficiently informed us, both in the annual report and in the strat plans. They have spoken quite a lot about capacitation and also the financing. So I see the response on the financial implications, But I think that has to be tightened up. There has to be a commitment. Any legislation must have financial commitments. We can't pass legislation in Parliament that does not have a financial commitment. They really must go to, they must go together. The second thing that I want to say, I'm going to look for my facts on this one, but I don't think we can say there won't be any security implications. The nature of the bill is about the fact that there are fraudulent activities in the country. And so I think we've got to rethink when we say there won't be any security implications on that. I'm saying that because the bill seeks to correct behavior out there of people that want to take shortcuts in life. Now, the figures that Honorable Killian gave us are figures that they bring to us all the time, and it suggests that SACWA has been doing quite a bit in this area already. They have been able to pin down people, so much so that they could prove to Parliament what they have done in this instance, and they have shown to us that they had thus far some ability to make sure that they can ensure that people are arrested. What you have to convince us in the bill is the nexus between that which SACWA currently is doing and that which you seek to ask for in the bill. Are you taking it away from justice and bringing it to higher education, or are you bringing it together? Maybe if you can help to clarify us on that one. The members are correct. You see, when people see we usher in legislation to stop many different behaviors, they do other things. You've been having an endless battle in getting rid of many institutions that just pop up all the time, all of them very illegal and so on. Do you think to bring in this legislation will solve the entire problem, or can't you consider, together with whatever you said about GCIS, but together with that, a public education program? Because many a times those that fall foul to these issues are young people that get caught up with these aspects also. So we don't see that. We're not convinced that if you just punish people, it will solve the problem. There's got to be other things that are put are being ushered in to deal with the aspect. When somebody is in matric, they should know when they go to higher education and training that these are the things that they have got to look out for. We don't think we can leave it out. The last thing that I wanted to say is, please clarify, the bill seemed to, on face value, suggest everyone else out there, but does not speak to in the public service itself where you are sitting with this problem, what are being suggested. Are you just, is this just general, or are you not putting in place what do we actually do in the public service also? In the absence of any further hands, can I ask you to decide how you're going to answer the questions, and please share the questions amongst yourself also. You forgot to introduce the people that are with you. Take the opportunity to do that also.
Thank you, Jess. I apologize for not introducing the other colleagues. I'm Yvonne Boshoff, and next to me is Dr. Shirley Lloyd. I've also got Advocate Van der Wal, who is in the DG's office, and we've got Agent Marcelina, who's also in the
DG's.
Sorry, Chair, can he speak into the mic? We can't hear properly.
I apologize. Hear, and Advocate Van der Wal, take a bow.
professor sitting behind me, and Mr. James Mashilela, also from the DG's office. And then I've got on my right hand side my two colleagues that's working in the legal section. It's Mr. Msani Makanya, he's the director dealing with assistance, legal assistance to education institutions, and also Mr. Matthew Mogele, who is also a senior legal admin officer in the directorate. I apologize to
We've got
also Mr. Martin Mackay, who is in the special advisor in the minister's office. But Dr. Lloyd will start off with responding to the questions, and I will just add a few comments along, and any of the colleagues will also be
Thank you very much, Chair and Honourable Members. I'm going to start off with Mr. Van der Westhuizen, Honourable Member Van der Westhuizen's questions. I'd like to respond to the question by saying we recognise different kinds of education and training delivery. One of them being informal, which is what you learn at the knee of your grandmother or your mother or father, and yet that is also learning. The other one is what we call non-formal. No providers of non-formal learning, and non-formal could be anything, sitting in a 2 or 3 day course, learning to be a better leader, or learning a particular skill, cooking, whatever the case might be. Those providers do not have to be accredited by a quality council, and they do not have to be registered by the state, because they are not offering credit-bearing education and training, qualification or part qualification. However, the NQF Act, the current Act, and the Skills Development Act are very clear. If you are offering a qualification or part qualification, or a unit of learning that has to be formally assessed for credit, then you need to be accredited by a quality council, one of the three, and you then have to be registered by the state. The movement between the SAQA Act, which was then replaced by the NQF Act, recognized that the establishment of the Quality Council on Trades and Occupations created a bit of a challenge for a transitional period, because it was a brand new organization starting and would not have the capacity, therefore, to be able to deal with all the providers delivering what we call occupational qualifications registered on their sub-framework. So initially, over a period, only providers in the higher education space and your TVET colleges, etc., offering qualifications which were accredited by either the Council on Higher Education, or the CHE, or UMALUSI, they still had to be registered. But we had a transitional phase for those offering occupational qualifications. That transitional phase is now being called in, if I can use that word, and they need to now be compliant with the constitutional requirements, and we are working in that space. We recognize that the process of registration and accreditation, and I think this picks up on part of Professor Bazzoli's question as well, around simplification. We recognize that for an NGO, an NPO, a small or micro enterprise, it's a complex process. We recognize the current forms are quite lengthy and difficult to complete. The requirements are difficult. So we have an agreement now with the Quality Council on Trades and Occupations that when they accredit a small provider that only offers maybe a niche program formally for credit, that the department will accept the bona fides of the QCTO letter saying we have accredited them and all of these documents have already been seen and verified and they correct, and therefore we are going to, through that mechanism, simplify the registration process for OQSF registered providers. The others aren't affected because they are already registered. So that's one of the mechanisms. So we differentiate informal, non-formal. You don't have to be formal. You do have to be. Your other question around the satellite issues for foreign providers. We've had numbers of providers that are foreign providers or institutions registered in other countries, and yet they have a satellite campus here in South Africa. Advocate Boshoff and I have been working very closely with SACWA to address the issue of how we can maintain the credibility and also foreground the quality of South African qualifications, and yet at the same time recognize we live in a global society. So what we have done and what SACWA is doing now, there's a policy being developed that actually addresses the fact. But the NQF Act is clear. If you want to offer a qualification in South Africa, it has to be registered on the NQF. So as an example of what we've done with one or two of these foreign providers, they've agreed to reconfigure their qualifications and NQF them in terms of the content and how it's structured and have those registered on the NQF. And then at the same time, the international institution will recognize the learning outcomes. So there's that type of agreement that is emerging. We've also recognized that sometimes there are very big, like the World Maritime University matter, and there are specific agreements with SACWA that SACWA will recognize those qualifications delivered. This, similarly in the computer space, computer learning. So there are very, very clear steps being taken now to allow the learning to be recognized internationally, but still to make sure our NQF retains a credibility status globally. In that same context, I'd like to add that what South Africa has done, and through SACWA, which is the body that has to do that, we have very successfully signed agreements with the Groningen Declaration Network, which is a network of now 110 countries who verify and ensure together the credibility of each other's qualifications across the world. So if SACWA has a provider coming to it and a learner with a qualification from another country, there's this massive network where they can verify, is that institution accredited in the country and what is the status? And from there they work. There's also the African Qualification Verification Network, which is a new 2 years old, and that is a very, very credible new initiative between SACWA and, I think at the moment, about 15 African countries. Then we have the SADC Qualification Verification Network, which was again reconfirmed by the ministers at our recent SADC Education Ministers meeting. So there are global moves in the recognition, and this picks up again on one of the questions around, we recognize there are massive online open courses. We recognize open education resources. We recognize the whole digitization move, learning anywhere, anytime, all of that. And these mechanisms are now in place to support those credibility issues. This particular bill does not speak to that in detail, but those are contained in policies. The policy of SACWA on foreign qualification evaluation, assessment, all of those. So there's already a policy layer that can support what the bill is trying to do in the process. There are also one of the issues that where SACWA has had to tighten up. When this was first mooted and the erstwhile minister, Dr. Nzimande, raised it, Cabinet approved that all levels of government should ensure that we have at national, provincial and local government measures in place through which qualifications of employees, consultants, boards of state-owned entities would be verified by SACWA. And so that has happened. The letters went out. All the different ministries sent letters back to say we agree. And that's one of the tightening up measures across all the levels. But we believe as we implement further and work with SACWA, we get every 2 months SACWA is now required to report to our minister on all instances of fraud and misrepresentation. This bill also seeks to address the issue by saying it is compulsory for a company, a provider, an institution, wherever, to report any misrepresentation they come across, reported to SACWA. And SACWA, in turn, works with SAPS, South African Police Services, to take the process further. The fact that the register was not previously allowed to be an open document, that is being addressed also through the bill and through other processes, that it will be an open online register where all of these, to use the term name and shame, but in that term. So it will be an open register accessible to people, and we believe that will help a lot. In terms, Professor Bazzoli, of simplification, I think that simplification of the forms, the quality councils whose bona fides will count so that the people do not have to redo, and the issue of informal, non-formal not having to be registered. So we're looking at that, and we believe that will help a lot. But we also deal on a case-by-case basis as the issues come through, and eventually we trust that those will be less and less, that we don't have so many. In terms of the fraudulent tightening up, we recognize, and my office has dealt in particular with all the high-level cases of in high-level public servants cases and state-owned entities. We've dealt with those misrepresented and fraudulent qualification matters and advised the minister, and SACWA has dealt with them. So we're very aware of the fact that there have been quite a few of those. But we believe now, by making it an obligation when you come across it to report it to SACWA, which was not previously in the Act, we hope to stretch the net wider. So that if you are the employer and somebody presents a qualification and it's not credible, it's fraudulent, you are now obligated. And there is also the penalties and offences issue, which previously was not in the Act. I cannot guarantee today that will be 100% effective, but I think it certainly strengthens what we have currently had to do, and it enables us to have a mechanism, as well as having this online and paper-based hard copy register. The Honourable Kikana, in terms of the skills issues, and this is I think this is one of the very big, significant issues that our minister has recently moved on. Our minister, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, established the recognition of prior learning reference group. The directorate currently functions as the national coordinating mechanism for recognition of prior learning. One of the gaps was we needed the reference group to be in place. There have been many examples of very, very successful recognition of prior learning. And just as an aside, but I think it's pertinent, I wrote my doctoral thesis on that, and in my doctoral thesis, 40,000 people were affected over a period of a number of years, the Honourable Kikana, and it is a very important issue our minister has recognised. To look at all of those, exactly what you are saying, the people who've worked with the father or the grandfather, etc. So there are recognition of prior learning processes, one for apprentices, we call the apprentice RPL, the others are broader. So we have many different models and kinds, and we have policy layers, Minister's policy, SACWA policy, and we're busy aligning the Quality Council's policies for RPL to address those very issues. In terms of people who might have studied in Bulgaria, Romania, those countries, part of the positive effect of Groningen Declaration Network
if some of those countries are included. And so SACWA will be able to work with those agencies to put on the list who are the credible providers, do they have quality counsel type of organizations, and how do we recognize their qualifications in line with our 10-level framework. So it's a work in progress, Honourable Kekana, but it is a key focus for our minister at this time, and it really brings back the 1988-89 driver by the trade union movement pre-94 to make sure that people have an opportunity for redress, transformation in the system, and this is one of the big transformation mechanisms. Honourable Killian, thank you that you support the tightening up, but you obviously have very key concerns as well, and I hope we've managed to address it to say yes, the register will be a public register, it will be an online register, it will be available. The details of how that will roll out, SACWA is in fact at this stage working on that very issue, and we'll be providing the minister with a report on what that should constitute and what it should look like. In terms of the question, are we doing footwork, the institutions, there is a lot of work happening, but it's insufficient to really clamp down on it as we want to right now. So what is being done? The SACWA CEO chairs a committee called the CEO's Committee, which comprises the four CEOs of SACWA and the three quality councils. The department is also part of that committee. There's a subcommittee called the Communication and Advocacy Committee, and there we are now developing a policy and infographics and statements and social media, so we're taking it wide and deep to communicate what the criteria are. When you as a parent, a grandparent or a learner goes to a place, you need to look for two or three things. Two things, first of all, are they accredited? Number one, there must be a statement. And number two, have they got the registration certificate? The third thing we encourage people to look at, is this program non-formal or is it formal for credit? If it's marketed as formal for credit, then you must be accredited and registered, and that must be stipulated up front. The second thing that SACWA is doing for us is making the National Learners Records Database more user-friendly, so that when people want to look, is this provider a really good provider, is it there, is it registered, can we count on it, that they can actually access and go and look on the NLRD whether it is there. So it's not perfect, we acknowledge, but we believe the move is there to tighten up on just doing the street work on bogus colleges. The other institutions, I'm just looking here, registered diplomas and courses, if they're not accredited. SACWA and the Quality Councils are working together at the moment to review a current policy that exists on the registration of qualifications and part qualifications. We recognize that it had some gaps, and currently they are reviewing all the policies to have a look at how they can work together to ensure credibility and to ensure that when a qualification is placed on the NQF, it is at the right level. And we also, and the Amendment Act makes a very, very important statement. What you found was some providers would believe once the CHE has accredited them that that's okay, but the qualification wasn't yet registered on the NQF, and that's problematic. So the bill amends that and says you cannot walk around and say, I can offer it, if SACWA hasn't yet registered the qualification or part qualification on the NQF. So it first has to be registered, then the Quality Council can finally give you your accreditation certificate. So that correction and the communication around that, we believe, will help a lot. And that goes across the board for all the qualifications. The international accreditation I think I've spoken to that about Frinnigan and those people. Ms. Dudley, Honourable Ms. Dudley, medical students. There's a committee established in the department. I chair that committee at the moment. It's called the Mutual Recognition of Qualifications Committee. And this is a top agenda item. We have people from University of South Africa, from all the QCs, from SACWA, from the professional bodies, and we're specifically dealing with Engineering Council and Health Professions Council because that is where we found the two biggest challenges for returning students, and we have a process in place now with SACWA, and then where we are agreeing on the qualification parity of esteem, because that was a huge problem. So the parity of esteem issue, South African universities didn't necessarily recognize the quality level and exit level outcomes of those qualifications. SACWA is working with the professional bodies and with the different countries to amend it. Two other things which I think are important in this context, last week at the BRICS summit, in one of the side meetings, our minister signed the BRICS Mutual Recognition of Qualification Agreement, which goes a long way now to help this issue, because now we are bound. Before the Mutual Recognition Agreements were signed, they were thoroughly discussed, debated, consulted in the MRQ committee, and then widened to those constituents, own constituencies. So we believe now with the Chinese one done, Russia we have one which is signed, and we're moving with others, that this is the beginning to address those things where students find themselves unable to continue or pursue studies. I think, Chair, that's from my side.
All right.
Thank
Let's
you, Chair.
Go that way. Thank you very much, Dr. Lloyd.
Thank you very much. I just want to make an input with regard to the submission made by Honorable Killian. The question which he posed was in relation to where the courts have found, have made a finding in relation to the fraudulent qualification. The question was whether will those also be put in the register. So in response to that, the bill as it stands under Section 4, subsection 1, capital B, 66 to address that, that the, where there is a finding by a court of law, that should be also be referred to where is the case to the professional body consent, and also that should also be part of, will also be registered in the bill, whether as misrepresented or fraudulent qualifications. For instance, I can draw your attention to subsection 4, 1 capital D, C, D, where it says the nature, you also have to record the nature of the offense and the sentence on the receipt of the details from the reference. So the bill is seeking to address that fundamental question that you have actually raised. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'd like to address also the point that was raised by on the issue of this, on the symbol of the simplification of the rules. Currently, as a department, we are looking into the legislative mechanism on how to deal with the skills development providers in order to bring them in line with the provision of Section 29.3 of the Constitution, because currently, the skills development provider does not, the Skills Development Act does not make provision for their registration, but it only makes provision for their accreditation. As a department, we are currently looking into the legislative mechanism that are not cumbersome, because we've received complaints from the skills development providers. Some of them, they say they can't meet the requirements of registration either as higher education institutions or as private colleges because of the requirements. Most of them, we've been informed that they are voluntary association and they are registered as non-profit organization. And whereas the requirement in the CET Act, it requires the entities to be registered as companies. So we are looking at that. On the issue of Honorable Van der Westhuizen, with regards to foreign satellite institution, currently the issue is addressed in the CET Act. With regards to the satellite foreign institution, currently the Act, Section 28 of the CET Act, states that no person can offer education if that person is not either a public college or an organ of state or is registered as a private college in terms of the CET Act. And when you go to Regulation 11 of the regulations for registration of these colleges, that regulation provides that if an entity in South Africa wants to offer a qualification on behalf of a foreign institution, they still have to be registered, and in their application, they must submit proof that the parent institution is registered in its country of origin and is accredited in its country of origin. So in that way, it is catered for. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Bosse, can you also answer consequential?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Chair, the issue of the aspect that has been raised about the offering of a qualification is a very interesting debate, because if you are just providing aspects of it, are you offering or is it not? And it's relating to the online, the question on the online foreign institution, we just use a organization in South Africa. They say, we're not offering, we just provide computers for the people to come and sit down and be assessed or comply with specific aspects, but the offering is coming from outside the country. Chair, the current legislation is saying that if you offer in the country, you must comply with the laws of the country. And the issue is not the person who provides the facilities in South Africa, but the one that is offering it through that facilities, that is where the focus is. We've had a few examples. The GDE qualification is one of them, where we are engaging with SACWA in order to see how we can deal with it and keep the institution in the foreign country accountable to our laws in our country and get them to comply, or if they don't comply, deal with it in terms of the legislative framework. But yeah, it is complex because it is dealing with a institution that is not under our jurisdiction, although the impact of their activities falls within our jurisdiction, and that is what we are dealing with. Chair, it is also important that when we are dealing with the consequences, it is important that the provisions that has been put in place is, and it is dealing with the issue of the footwork, that to implement it across the townships and the small rural areas. The approach is to say, let's use the employers and the education institutions and the skills development providers and the QCs as the filters. And if you read clause 32 capital A, the purpose is to say, if the system picks up a problem with a qualification as misrepresented or fraudulent, the obligation is on those filters, those institutions identified, to
to then report it and to bring it into the system, and that the consequence management will therefore then follow through that process. The consequence management will be to deal with the formal identification by SACWA of that specific action to be either fraudulent or misrepresented, and the outcome of that will now have a specific status and also be reported in a different but very relevant frameworks, and will be accessible to the broader public. And the consequences of a fraudulent qualification, because of the nature of it, is a very serious offence. It is linked to an outcome of a court of law. So, Chair, the responsibility has been identified for SACWA to manage that process with the assistance of the employers, with the assistance of education institutions, skills development providers. And the outcome of that will be reflected on a public system where access is given to all those affected by the impact of that behavior or that specific outcome which is not compliant to the standards prescribed by our legislation. Chair, it is also important that if you look at the provisions of Clause 32, capital A, sub 2, that verification and evaluation, which is key concepts that's now built into this legislation, when it comes to qualifications and part qualifications, SACWA must, in the exercise of that function, have the opinion that it is in line with the requirements and standards, and if so, there's an obligation to give it the necessary recognition. If SACWA, after considering everything, is found that it is not in line with the requirements, there's an obligation to reflect it on that sub-framework as either fraudulent or misrepresented. It brings clarity to the legislative framework. It also provides an obligation to specific structures in the system to take the responsibility and to weed out qualifications that are not compliant to the legislative framework. Chair, it is also important that this provision is supported by the amendments to the offences, which is in Clause 32, capital B, where it speaks to the same principles, where the qualification, part qualification, must comply with standards. It must be reflective of the quality outcomes that is prescribed, and if it is based on fraud, that process must go its course, and the outcome of that will have some consequences to the perpetrators, not only in the judicial. And Chair, it is in relation to your question in particular, it is not that we are taking over the role of the Department of Justice. We don't have the mandate, we don't have the authority to do that. It's the President that assigned a functional area to a specific minister, and the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services got the mandate to deal with the court system. What we are saying, Chair, is that this is in support of the justice system in order to make sure that criminal activities must be dealt with and must be reported in a proper manner, and to address an obligation on our system and our structures within our system to work with the law enforcers in order to obtain that goal. Chair, it is also important that although it is possible to deal with it in terms of common law offences, it is also a known fact that with fraud you get so many verifications and specialisation when it comes to fraud that this is one, just one of the examples that we can put on the table, which is not unique to education, but or in many sectors, that you want to specialize that type of offense so that the impact of enforcement becomes easier to control than the ordinary broad common principles attached to that specific offense. So Chair, the intention is to simplify the implementation and to be very specific in the rollout and the method of obtaining the outcome, but reflecting the, whatever the final outcome is in a system which is accountable and which is in compliance with all the legislative principles underpinning educational qualification and the offering of qualification to our students. So the last issue that I just want to also refer to is the issue of the awareness and how the bill and the process to deal with that. It is absolutely correct. The bill got a specific purpose. It provides a legal framework, but once that framework is in place, there is a further obligation on the minister, the department, and the role players in the so-called NQA family to ensure that the effect of the legislative framework, as supplemented by this bill, so it's not only this bill, but the totality of the legislation, is conveyed, is is made accessible and informing our public about the implications of that. So Chair, it is important that the communication strategies that we've alluded to is a very important aspect of the rollout of the legislation. And the issue of the security implications that you refer to, the aspect of security is obviously it can have different interpretations. What we've tried to indicate is that the it is not an aspect which is security is not the aspect or the focus of this bill. The security is also covered in the existing legislation, where the need to ensure that our systems are authentic, are dealt with in a by the institutions who is performing the education, the Quality Council's responsibility to ensure the credibility of the qualifications. The security is also linked with the certification processes, which are already covered in the legislation. All those security factors are already in place, and the bill is not addressing that at all. The bill is just adding to it by also assisting the making available the publication of outcomes, which is not always known and which is not easily accessible. And to that aspect, it also contributes to security because it protects the integrity as well. So, Chair, the bill must be read in the totality of the legislative framework. Chair, I think all the issues have been addressed with my colleagues, unless I did not identify who can respond further.
Thank you very much, everyone. May I check with you, honourable members, have your questions been asked, and if you might want additional burning question that you wish to ask, Honourable van der Westhuizen and Kubisa. I notice your hands. Go for it, Honourable van der Westhuizen.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think one of the things which we as Parliament really need to always guard against is when government starts to intend abusing some of the powers that it may have. And whenever we speak of a name and shame list, you know, I immediately see some red lights going on. Now, I do know that this bill
proposed bill says that for the verification and evaluation processes, SACWA will have to conform to the provisions of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. But my concern is, Chair, apart now that they've verified this and evaluated this, what rights do I have as an individual who may have, and people make mistakes, who may find that my name is now listed on this public register by mistake? It's the name of the holder of the qualification or part qualification that will be contained in that list. That's my understanding. Perhaps we can just get clarification, because it seems to me that we understand that differently. But my question is just, my question is just, you know, shouldn't we include in here that there must be provision for appeal processes, etc., that not only the verification, but also when it comes to the publishing. Because, Chair, what I've found is people sometimes believe that they have obtained a qualification. I've recently had a case where a lady who assisted a domestic worker was very upset because the lady received the assessment reports, everything was 100%. But when the moderator came around months later, one of the unit standards was not covered, because that particular piece of the file of evidence was no longer there. And now she's been withheld her qualification. Now, you know, I've been very critical of this Rolls Royce that we are trying to plow fields with. I do think we're making it far too difficult. We want South Africans rather to gain skills than to have barriers towards them progressing in life. So what would be the rights, and should we not include a section in here that will say that there must be a procedure when publishing this which will also adhere to administrative justice for those listed? Thank you.
Honourable Kabisa.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I wanted to follow up on the financial, the number one, the financial implications that you touched on, whether that was covered. That's the first one. The second one is, it's more of a comment. I think public education is important in this regard, because my colleague stated that side, that in order to be accredited as an institution, you need to be an entity. For instance, you must be, in the past, you'd have to be a CC or a PTY LTD, then you'll apply to the department to be accredited accordingly. Then it would be a process, a very long process. But more often than not, you find that even the NPOs and NGOs get tempted. You know, they educate people, and then they give them diplomas, and people think that those diplomas are genuine. But at the end of the day, you find that, no, these certificates are not accredited, because they are neither accredited with the FITAS nor with the department. So I think my comment tallies with that of Professor Pozole and the Chair, who said there's a lot of education that is needed. Because within institutions themselves, you find that we don't have those who are trained as assessors or moderators, those who can accredit accordingly within themselves before it goes to education. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, honourable members, I think that part of honourable van der Westhuizen's question, part of it, honourable van der Westhuizen, we have to answer ourselves on the processing, and you know, if we want to make any amendments on the bill, if you feel that the bill is not strong enough into a particular direction, that will be our business, that we must sort it. It's not their business anymore. They have complied with everything, and the bill is here in our domain now, so we must, within reason, obviously, see what it is that we do with the bill before it gets to the National Assembly. But if there's a section that you still want to answer on clarifying what he is saying. I'm sure you're not going to say yes or no on whether you can include that in the bill, because that's we have to deal with that aspect. And then I think the other clarification that the member of us, they did answer my question on the financing, but I'll hand over to yourself too.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, we agree with your analysis. The issue of amendments, it is for this committee to give guidance on it and to consider what is needed. Chair, the one aspect that one must also take into account is that we are talking about an administrative action, and there are a number of other legislation which already deals with the promotion of administrative action, already provide for appealing mechanism. The Poppy Act, there's an array of legislation, and to add just more of the same to the mix may not have necessarily a different effect to what is already currently on the statute books. But I mean, it is important that when we are dealing with the issue of the practicalities, that was also put on the table as to how a specific case has been dealt with. Legislation cannot deal with that practicalities. That legislation provides a framework within which the implementation must be rolled out. And if there is, on a specific case, a problem with the evidence that's provided on a specific mode, legislation cannot deal with that. It is a practicality where the framework is wide enough for the responsible institutions to deal with it in accordance with the system. So, Chair, the aspects, as you indicated, about the financial implications, I think we have already covered that. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Kekana, is that a burning question?
Chair, we discussed in this, and I thought I should just make this input. Well, I just want an explanation. If we're doing an amendment like we're doing it now, and members...
No, we're not doing amendments now.
Yeah, this bill, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're not amending the bill.
Okay.
In this meeting.
Yeah, I'm saying if we're doing the bill... Sorry, this is my own phrasing, that's wrong. If we're doing the bill like we're doing it now, and members feel there's an area that needs to be captured, but we can't express this in legal terms because we're not lawyers, is it not the duty of the presenters, when they hear there's a loophole, to include it and capture it, and do the bill size that it captures, that rather than just pass the bill, it goes, and one day, maybe after 6 months or 5 years, we feel low, we still need to go back to this bill. I'm just saying what the last two colleagues raised, is it not possible that it can be included by being captured properly in the bill, legally speaking?
Thank you, honourable members. That brings me nicely to the legal people that are there here in the meeting. Is it different, honourable Mtunu? Because what I wanted to suggest is, I think there's just some legal clarifications on the processing of the bill. We need to just confer with the legal people. But go ahead, honourable Mtunu.
It's different, Chair. I wanted to know, I'm reminded that there was a draft national policy on the misrepresentation of qualifications. I just wanted to know whether that one that was published for public comment in 2017, I think it was January, I just want to know whether that has been finalized. I believe that it would be nice for the committee to have it so that we can have a view, because some of the things may not necessarily be on the bill, but may find expression in the national policy. Thank you, Chair.
I am sure that the department can assist the committee with that, in as well as making sure that we receive from the Department of Monitoring and what? That impact assessment, if you can give that to us also on what they have said, because we didn't hear you saying anything about it in the submission.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, on the last aspect, the bill was subjected to the assessment, the social economic evaluation assessment by the Department of DPME, public enterprise. But the outcome was that they support that the bill must go. We will provide the documentation to the committee that they will see the certification that has been formally approved by the CIAS process. Just the aspect of the policy. There was a draft policy on misrepresentation, but it became so difficult to implement the policy, and the legal advice also was that it requires an amendment to the legislation, that the policy has been withdrawn in order to put this framework in place, in order to provide the support and the enforcement to the policy. Otherwise, it would just be attacked, and the implementation would be very, very difficult to deal with. So that policy was shelved up until and was replaced by this process. I thank you, Chair.
All right. We'll deliberate a little bit more on that aspect of the policy and so on. Did you answer my question on consequential of other acts? You did?
I thought I did, Chair.
Okay, maybe I didn't, yes.
But if I can elaborate more, Chair, the issue of the consequential aspect is, first of all, it is there is a responsibility assigned through the legislation, which is by identifying and follow through on not only dealing with it as an allegation, but move it through so that it is an outcome. In the case of a fraudulent allegation, that it is going through the court systems and the outcome will have a consequence to that. When it comes to dealing with misrepresented, as I've already indicated, we've already had some amendments to the Higher Education Act to deal with correcting that mistake and by a formal withdrawal within a specific time frame. That's already on the statute books. And Chair, with this process, it is also identifying the status, and the obligation is now on SAQA to clarify the status of that qualification and to reflect it within the correct placement on the NQF. And the consequences of that must also be communicated, and the clarification will then affect decisions by the employers and educational institutions in order to advance the recognition that is relevant to the qualification as it is, not as reflected on a certificate, but according to the standards, will then be the way forward. That also has some consequences to it, because it brings clarity to the fact that persons will now have the advantage of what they achieve, and also take away the stigma that this is fraud, it is a false, it is a qualification that has no value. So it will correct that, which is also advancing the system as well. I don't know, Dr. Lloyd, if you want to add on the consequences.
Yes, no. All right. Honourable members, I take it that you have exhausted most of the questions to the department. Just before we end the meeting, if I can turn my attention to the procedural aspects of the passaging of the bill. If you can just, Ms. Hendricks, introduce the other gentleman. I must apologize, I forgot his name already. Work with us on the bill.
Chair, I'm Ms. Fatima Ibrahim from Legal Services, and I have with me Mr. Mbalelo Ruda, who is a new parliamentary legal advisor who just joined us a month ago.
So he will work closely with us on the bill. Thank you very much for that, Ms. Ibrahim. May we ask the following questions? Are there any questions that you wish to put to them, honourable members? That will be fine. But let me just ask in particular, we're in recess at the moment, and if you can clarify to us, I mean, the rules does make provision for us to deal with legislation, that the committee can receive and the speaker can refer legislation to us, even if it's during recess. If you can clarify, especially as it relates to Rule 286, the entire processing of that. So for example, if we were to, not we were to, we have to, honourable members, obviously send the bill out for public comment. It's not a choice. We have to do that. We're not going to find ourselves on the side of the Constitutional Court also ruling against us for not doing that. Do we take into consideration that we're in recess now? If we were to take 3 weeks for people to make a comment, if you can clarify, when does the first week kick in? My calculation is, if we were to do that, then we might ask that by the 20th of August, people would have, that will be the last day for everyone to make a comment on the bill. If you can clarify that one. The second one is, there's something strange that has crept into the National Assembly as it relates to the first reading and the second reading. We see more and more, it's been lumped together. Now, whether that's the programming committee that has taken it upon themselves to do that, seems like it. But the first reading of the bill, the rules says that we obviously have to commence with. Can we lump the two together? Can we start the processing only after the first reading, and how lawful is it to lump the first and the second reading together? Because the first reading is really just, I have to say to the House, this is what it is, and so on, so on. There's no decision that is taken on the matter, or at least the Minister introduces the first reading. If you can clarify that, as it was all part of the processing, the processing of the bill. The second reading is obviously when we have done everything else, done everything, then we do that. But the first reading is the one that I'm picking up. There's some strange things that has crept into that process. Unless there are any questions from yourself, honourable members. Over to yourself.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, we don't ordinarily advise on procedural issues, but I'll try to assist the committee as best I can and be supported by the committee secretary. On the first issue about the recess period, the courts are clear that Parliament determines its own rules and processes, and the rules certainly allow for committees to meet within the recess period, and my understanding is that permission has been granted for this meeting, and that the bill was validly referred to the committee for consideration. So certainly the committee can continue with the legislative processing issues from this point on. As you correctly point out, the first step is that we do call for public participation. That's a constitutional obligation, and the fact that we're on the recess period shouldn't affect that. Nonetheless, because we are in recess and because the general public is also aware of the fact that we are in recess, I do think we just need to take some extra measures to ensure that our public participation process is a little bit more robust. So my suggestion is to identify stakeholders, to send them copies of advertisements, because we don't want a situation where people may have missed it because they weren't expecting that we would be dealing with legislation in this time. But certainly we can continue. On the issue of first and second readings, I think the confusion may come in on a type of bill, an executive bill, which is a bill that's brought by the department on behalf of the minister. Those bills have two readings. A bill that doesn't have two readings would be, for example, a committee bill, because a committee bill is being, the starting point of such a bill is within the committee itself. So that may be where some of the confusion is creeping in, but this is an executive bill. So the rules would need to be followed, and there would need to be a first and second reading of the bill, Chair.
Okay. Having heard that answer, Honourable Killian.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think, yes, Parliament is not sitting at this stage, but nothing stops us to take a resolution in terms of Rule 286. 286 sub 6, and that is, we have done subsection A says informal discussion, that's what we've had today. Then we go to sub C, which says we go for an invitation for further public comment. And then I would like to propose that we actually consider, because there's no clarity, there's no specific provision for how long, but I would like to suggest that we move for a 21-day period, once it's published, 21-day period for the public to comment, and the public obviously to comment on the published bill and, you know, give us details so that once we have received everything, we can consider it. And depending on the response from out there, decide how many public hearings should we schedule as a committee. The other day, I was part of a different bill, and in fact, Chairperson, we had one reply, and it was actually a misguided reply, so we didn't have any public hearings on it. So it depends on what happens. But we must comply in terms of our rules. We must comply with that, and I do want to suggest that we abide strictly by our rules, because in all these exercises we have seen in the past that some entities have in fact questioned processes followed. So let's rather err on the side of caution than missing out on any of the processes. So that would be my suggestion, Chairperson.
So, I think you agree with the 20th. Just around 3 weeks. Yeah. So, honourable members, I think the second comment that was made, I think it's useful. We can certainly do that. We will generate our own list to make sure we can reach out to the sector and beyond, and inform them that the committee wish to hold public hearings on this matter, and tell them the cut-off date when they must apply and by when they must respond. And then they can also, and then we obviously, honourable members, do all the ordinary stuff, which is, you know, publicise, pay all this big amount of money to the media charges us a lot of money to say a few words in the newspaper. We will do all of that, honourable members, and then we ask that the cut-off date be the 20th of August, which is then a week after we return, and we will then take a decision on the further processing of the bill based on the any submissions that we would receive. We will inform the minister and the department on processing. And in the meantime, honourable members, we have to obviously think as members about the bill and what we would like to do with the content of the bill. And I think that obviously, having listened to anyone else, we will do the necessary in the processing. I think there's nothing else other than that processing, if I'm correct, that we have to attend to. We will have discussions with the Chief Whip on the first reading, second reading, well, not the second reading, the first reading matter, and inquire from them. But I don't think that we can't not send out the bill for public hearings whilst we wait on the response on the first reading. Am I correct? We don't have to wait.
Chair, that's my understanding, but we would need the procedural staff to confirm that. The difference between the first and second reading is that the first reading, we just look at the long title and the objects of the bill, whereas the second reading is where we get into the deliberations and the meat of the bill. So there would be no changes that would really emanate from a first reading in any event. So I can't foresee why there would be a problem for us to continue in the meantime, but I'm subject to correction from the procedural staff.
Right. You will, if there's anything different, you will come back to us. But my understanding also is there's nothing wrong for us to ask for public comment on the bill in the meantime. We will engage on the first reading aspect on that. Honourable members, I think we've now covered everything as far as I'm concerned on the bill. When we come back, obviously the bill takes priority on our agenda as opposed to any other matter on the programme. And I think members will be updated all the time on what needs to happen in this regard. So there's some things that the department needs to send us that we have asked so that we can read through those things, and then we will take all the other matters as we have agreed in this meeting. It gives me great pleasure, honourable members, to thank you very much for your participation and for coming today. Equally, the department, and the ministry, and the legal people from Parliament, thank you very much also for your attention, attendance. We will continue to engage with all of you on that. Honourable members, I don't have any other reason to keep you here any longer, but to ask you to go and enjoy the rain outside, and thank you very much. The meeting has come to an end.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.